This episode of the Gospel Coalition podcast is brought to you by Operation Christmas Child, whose gift-filled shoeboxes will result in evangelism and discipleship for more than 4 million children this year. Learn how to pack a shoebox and find your drop-off at samaritanspurse.org/OCC. National Collection Week is November 12 to 19. This is the Gospel Coalition podcast, where we seek to renew the contemporary church in the ancient gospel of Jesus Christ. I'm your host, Colin Hansen. Today's podcast is a workshop by K.A. Ellis on learning from the examples of some of the first African-American Christians. It was recorded at TGC's 2018 Women's Conference in Indianapolis.
We're going to talk a little bit of history. We're going to talk a little bit of literature. And we're going to talk a little bit of ecclesiology, how the church functions. And by looking back, we're going to encourage ourselves to look forward. So we're going to be all over the place historically. Do I have any historians in here, people who just love history? Great. Yeah, what I love about history is the stories. And history for me lives when there's a story and a narrative attached. And do I have any people in here who love literature? Aha, yes. And what I love about literature are the stories. Because they come to life, literature comes to life when there's a narrative and a story attached. So at this place is where history and literature meet, is at the story, the storytelling and the narrative. So I want to tell you a story today that started for me in my research about 6 years ago now, when a young man that I admire very much, a Christian artist named Propaganda. Okay. Oh, all right. Y'all admire him too. Mm-hmm. And he, in 2012, he released a song called Precious Puritans. And some of you know it. And what he did in the song, in his spoken word, was to ask us and ask the church to help him process some of the more troublesome baggage that accompanied the tremendous good that the Puritans contributed to the church, and also, in contrast with that, some of the ethical issues that also accompanied that. Of course, the greatest of those issues being slavery in America, and the fact that it wasn't just whether or not these people owned slaves that was an issue. The more I research, there's a great book called Christian Slavery. It's just come out in the last few months by a woman named Catherine Gerbner. And she argues through church documents that it wasn't just the fact that a lot of church leaders owned slaves that was an ethical failure, a moral failure on their part. Because your ethics and your epistemology should match. Your ethics, well, how you obey God, hey girl, the ethics, how you obey God, and your epistemology, what you know about God, we always want them to match as close as possible. You can know all the right doctrine, but if it doesn't work itself out in your ethics, then your ethics and your epistemology are separated. That's what happened with a lot of these pastors that were not just owning slaves, but advocating for the establishment of slavery in certain states. So he's asking us to process all of this in the song. And it's not just that they owned slaves. It's that the ordinances of the church, the sacraments that identify the church as the church, were twisted. So a lot of people don't realize that at councils, like the canons of Dort, 1600s we're talking, on the table were the issues, people were discussing the issue, what do you do in baptism with a slave when a slave becomes a Christian? These things were being debated. So the ordinance of the church, baptism, the sacraments, baptism, the Lord's Supper, slaves were not allowed to drink from the common cup. Okay, so, and all of these things looked different from region to region. People came to different conclusions, and those things worked themselves out in church practice. And then, of course, the third one, which is the most obvious one, is discipline. If somebody's not obeying the word of God, how do you discipline them? Well, what do you do if the people that are exercising the discipline are the people who are not obeying the word of God? So here you have violations of the three ordinances of the church. So it goes much further beyond the fact that, oh, these people just own slaves. So he's asking us in this song, how do I reconcile these things? Interestingly, in all of those discussions, I'm watching happen, go back and forth, not many people are speaking of Puritans or even African Puritans or African Christians in that era. Did they exist? And if they did exist, what were they doing? Were they literate? What were they writing? What were they teaching at the time? So I want to introduce you to a generation shortly after the Puritan. They're just on the cusp of the Puritan era. And these are my precious Puritans. And let me tell you something about these folks. Their ethics and their epistemology matched. God always leaves a witness to his word. So I want to magnify them in the next few minutes. I'm going to take you on a journey and introduce you to a woman named Phyllis Wheatley. And in the New World, her ethics and her epistemology match. Now, you got to understand, the African Americans' rights were legislated away slowly over the course of decades. And it started as a cultural phenomenon, cultural disdain, cultural regarding of this particular group of people as less than human or other, and therefore not Christian. We weren't always slaves, and race-based slavery wasn't a foregone conclusion in early America. The first indentured servants of African descent who arrived on these shores, they came over on equal footing with Indian and European indentured servants. But in less than 100 years, as a matter of fact, in just about 60 years, they would hardly recognize the place that they had come to. They watched their right to property, access to education, family stability, freedom to assemble, freedom to worship freely. On and on and on and on were whittled away in less than 60 years. If I were going to give a definition to a word called marginalization, this is the definition I would give it. Marginalization is being relegated to a position of insignificance, devalued importance, minor influence, or diminished power. And yet, marginalization strengthened these early African American Christians and sustained, these believers were sustained through the cultural hostility. Marginalization is death by a thousand cultural cuts. Soft marginalization of Christian communities generally doesn't become extreme persecution overnight. It comes slowly and grows in barometric degrees, but it's something you can feel in the atmosphere. Now, people were using the Bible to justify slavery. Let's look at Philemon and Timothy and lay a foundation for that. It's tough for us to read as descendants of chattel slavery. I am now four generations removed from slavery. I can show you a picture of the plantation where my family was held. And one side of our family was our DNA traces to the Igbo in Nigeria. And the other side of our family traces to Scotland. And I don't need to explain to you how that happened. Okay. Chattel slavery is not the same as biblical slavery. Chattel slavery was a bastardization of slavery, the slavery servant system under Rome and in the Old Testament. And accepting those two systems as equal is suppressing the truth and unrighteousness, Romans 1. The Bible after the fall shows us God's stipulations on life as regulating sin. Slavery was never supposed to be. But God is like, I know what you're going to do. I know how you are. So let me give you some guidelines so that if you do have this repayment system under Rome to pay for existing debts, then let me make sure that that person who is marginalized now does not get abused. And so he gave stipulations for the kind. We talked earlier in my talk about the treatment of the widow, the orphan, the vulnerable. God is always regulating the treatment of the most vulnerable because he knows what lives in us. Just because the Bible regulates slavery doesn't mean God endorses the practice. You got me? Just because he regulates slavery doesn't mean that he endorses the practice. Now, how many of you are on Twitter? Retweet does not equal endorsement, right? Same with God. Retweet, just because he retweeted it, doesn't mean he endorses it. The whole foundation of the U.S. slavery system was based on ontological racism, which is sin at its core. It's the elevation of a people group to a godlike status over another people group. Paul wasn't endorsing slavery in those passages. The ultimate priority in those passages was the glory of God. He implored Philemon to set Onesimus free. He used it to justify slavery and not freedom is misuse. The entire meta-narrative of the Bible endorses freedom from bondage, spiritual as well as physical. And that is the ideal, not slavery. So let me set the stage for you. We're going back to the 18th century. The only thing I won't be able to give you is the smell. All right? But I can give you the sights, and I can give you the sounds. In 1721, the slave trader Platon Only requested that the Royal African Company capture 500 small slaves, male and female, from 6 to 10 years old, to be delivered annually aboard the slave ship called Kent. Legislation allowing for the capture and sale of African-American children had not yet been introduced at this point. But now that it's here, 1721 marks that day when scores, hundreds of children will now be introduced into the Middle Passage and stuffed like afterthoughts into the smallest and most suffocating areas of the ship, in whichever way they'll fit. If you've ever seen the cutaway of a slave ship where they're packed, the bodies are packed side by side, and you know there was tight pack, if they caught more, there was tight pack where you would lie on your side for months and make the journey. And then there was loose pack if they didn't catch as many as they wanted, and you would lie on your back for most of the journey. So the children are stuffed into these areas. Now, I know I have some trauma counselors in this room right now. Think about how we care for our children when they have trauma. Think about the trauma of being in that hold. The smell. Defecating and urinating where you sit, where you lie, then lying in that and having it roll over you, back and forth. People who've never been on water before, these are land people. So they're vomiting. Their stomachs are coming into, and that's rolling back and forth. So pestilence and disease, very common. And if you were marginally sick, if you couldn't be financially redeemed, then you were thrown overboard, and the insurance company would take care of the loss. From this pestilence, a voice rises. Phyllis Wheatley, born in 1754, is just 7 years old when she makes this trip. She will later write of her experience as a Christian and an American and abolitionist. And I want to introduce you to Phyllis and look at how faith and scripture, her poetry, her apologetic skill helped her reconcile the inconsistencies she saw of the culture around her, and how her pen and her divine gift shaped a voice that promoted both a temporal revolution and an eternal one. She wrote of her Middle Passage experience to the Earl of Dartmouth when she was an adult. And she wrote it this way. Oh, you've heard of Dartmouth University. This was before Dartmouth existed. It's named after him. So she's writing to him. She says, "I, young in life, by seeming cruel fate, was snatched from Africa's fancied happy seat. What pangs excruciating must molest? What sorrows labor in my parents' breast? Steeled was that soul, and by no misery moved, that from a father seized his babe beloved. Such was my case. And can I then but pray that others may never feel tyrannic sway?" Wheatley was brilliant. Her brilliance showed at an early age. After she was kidnapped from Senegambia, West Africa, at the age of 7, she was purchased at auction by the Wheatley household and given the name of the slaving vessel that she had just come from. So she was brought over on the vessel named Phyllis. And she was taught the English alphabet by the Wheatley's daughter. She was to be trained as a domestic. Now, in the slaving system, I'm sorry, this is an unfortunate comparison, but it really gives you the depth of depravity that we're talking about in this system. Do you know how when people raise dogs, they are like, oh, border collies, they're really good for rounding up the sheep and being on the farm. And if you want a German Shepherd, they're really good police dogs. And if you want a pit bull, yeah, you want to live in a rough area, you're going to get yourself a pit bull because they've got those jaws that lock, right? That was how we were classified. So if you wanted a particular kind of servant or a particular kind of slave, you went to a particular region that had been identified with a physicality. The people who developed the economy of the system, the slave traders. But I'm not going to take any questions because we have a lot. That's okay, no problem. We have a lot of material to get through. Appreciate that, though. Phyllis was trained as a domestic, and Senegal and Gambia was known as that region for those kinds of work. And the Christian Wheatleys, yes, the Wheatleys were Christian. They soon realized that she was destined for a life of service with a pen in her hand and not a broom. There's no record of exactly how she received her education. All we know is that at very least, they educated her well. She received her religious and theological education from the clergy of New England, and that she was educated well is to the credit of her owners, even if they offered her educational and spiritual freedom, even if they didn't offer her physical freedom. Legislation against educating slaves hadn't yet gotten to Boston, but it was discouraged, and it was actually thought of as impossible due to ontological racism, because we were perceived as being intellectually inferior. So 16 months after her purchase, now remember this, ontologically, we are intellectually inferior in this culture. She's living in Boston, in the North. 16 months after her purchase, at age 9, she's reading English with fluency and ease from the most difficult portions of the Bible. Though delicate in body, because the trip damaged her constitution, her physical constitution, she was strong in her mind and her ability. In addition to reading the sacred texts in English, she also mastered Greek and Latin, was reading Ovid and translating Virgil into English at the age of 10. By 14, she was catechized and she had been published. Ontologically inferior. She converted to Christianity at the age of 16, became a member of the Old South Congregational Church in Boston under the ministry of Reverend George Sewell, and then the tradition and teaching were in the tradition of the Evangelical and Reformed churches. So even though she was not a Puritan ecclesially, she was certainly one doctrinally and was likely doctrinally reformed. Woo woo! In 1773, her first literary work was published in the form of a small octavo, which is a book folded into eight pieces, and it came out to mixed acclaim in both the new colonies and England. Now, how many of you have The Valley of Vision in your libraries? Go get Phyllis Wheatley and put it beside them. You should own her first and only book of poems, and it's called Poems on Various Subjects, Religious and Moral. And her owner, Susanna Wheatley, helped finance the publication. As proof of her authorship, because ontological inferiority, the volume included a preface in which 17 Boston men claimed she had written the poems. She had to be interviewed. They forced her to write in Greek. They forced her to write in Latin. They forced her to translate. They forced her to write poetry on the spot. And after she had been interviewed and had defended herself, they agreed that she had actually written them herself and they were not being duped. Poems on Various Subjects is a landmark achievement in American history. She became, when it was published, the first African-American and the first U.S. slave to publish a book of poems, as well as the third American to do so. But these aren't all her works. There are other books that she has available. She had two forms of texts. There were the provincial ones, which were dealing with the local and global issues of the day. Those were her blogs, right? And then she had her classical works, based on the works of others, like Ovid's Metamorphosis, and Virgil, and the Aeneid, and Iliad, and the Odyssey, and Terence's comedies. Now, she wasn't just an author. She was also an extremely gifted businesswoman. And her publisher, his name was Archibald Bell, he referred to her as the Artful Jade, because rather than just publishing all of them in one whack, she said, I'm going to do a two-volume set. And she held back some of them and then published the first volume, got everybody interested. And they were like, oh, we need more. Always leave them wanting more. P.T. Barnum, right? Yeah. She was P.T. Barnum before P.T. Barnum was P.T. Barnum. And then she created the second volume and released those later. When she was enslaved, she received half of the proceeds from her published works, and the Wheatleys, the Wheatley family, received the other half. Her greatest critics, the Enlightenment thinkers. Isn't that incredible? Enlightenment. John Locke, incredible critic. Benjamin Franklin, even worse than Locke. But her greatest critic, Thomas Jefferson. Wheatley's work is in the style of Elizabethan and Jacobean English literature. And so it's basically iambic pentameter. Some of the pieces are in the Romantic style. Some of them are in the epic style of the classical Greeks and Homer. Very varied literary interests. But that's not all about Phyllis. Not only was she a writer, slave, and businesswoman, she was an apologist as well, and also an abolitionist. And she appealed, her artistic method that she used in her work was that she would appeal to the emotions of her readers to show the humanity that people of African and European descent shared. And so she based her argument on the moral superiority of enslaved Africans to hypocritical Christians. And she takes what culture told her was a defect and she turns it into a virtue. She often claims authority over her readers as an Ethiop rather than a black or African in order to assume that biblical authority. Why? Because the Ethiopian is all over the Bible. Moses married one. Psalm 68:31 predicts that Ethiopia shall soon stretch out her hands to God. A very common technique of the Friends also, the Friends denomination. These are the biblical counter-arguments that she used to racial self-hatred. She's Orthodox Congregationalist theology, presumably Reformed, we mentioned. And here are the common themes that show up in her writing. Natural revelation of God versus the special revelation. Focusing on a transcendent creator God who's sovereign over all his creation, who's benevolent no matter what the circumstances, and also omnipotent. Biblical authority and inerrancy. She's clearly theistic, and she wrote extensively on the rejection of atheism and deism, which I think is why Thomas Jefferson hated her. Wheatley's work reflects the themes of redemption, the image of God, original sin, total depravity, suffering for righteousness, the coming kingdom, and certainly the need for a savior. And she would have known through her abolitionist circles of Boston that Christians in America preached that the Bible justified slavery, but she had access not just to the English Bible, but she had access to the original languages. Seminarians, come on. I took Greek and Hebrew too, all right? She would have seen that this was inconsistent, not only with the teachings of Christ through the gospel, but through the original texts. She would have seen that slavery was inconsistent with Old Testament Israel in both ancient languages and the English, and she would have thought about this language of freedom from tyranny appropriated from the pulpit by Northern ministers to encourage freedom from the colonies from England. Now just imagine. Think about where we are historically. We're all British at this point. There is no America. Everybody's British. And the British that have come to America's shores are fighting for their freedom. And so they're sitting in their sermons, and of course the Africans are sitting in the balcony, not allowed to drink out of the common cup, not allowed to sit with the congregation. But they're sitting in the balcony and they're hearing the preachers preach all this talk about freedom. And Phyllis is probably thinking, wait a minute, wait a minute. Sitting in the slave section of the Old South Congregational Church of Boston, which still exists today, you can go and see it, and hearing this soaring language applied to the revolution, but not to her, caused her to put her pen to her paper. But when we look at history, no man is an island, and no woman is an island. There are always people around the historical figure. And this is one of the failures, I think, of how sometimes we teach history, is that it's always this person, these dates, these facts. But there's always a community of people around them. And so when you see them like that, you start, you guys ever see the, there used to be this online thesaurus called, what was it called? It was called the Living Thesaurus or something like that, and you click on it, and one word and all these other words would pop out and wave and bounce and settle. And then you click on that word and all these other words that are like that word would wave and bounce. That's what history is like. Everybody is connected to somebody else. So here are the people that were connected to Phyllis. And as we look at them, I want you to keep this in mind, this question. How do you exercise influence when you don't have authority? Because it can be done. How do you exercise influence when you don't have authority? Our first person related to Phyllis Wheatley and her community of character is Ignatius Sancho. Ignatius Sancho was a composer, an actor, and a writer. He was a neighbor and friend of other friends of Phyllis's. Sancho was himself born in 1729 on a slave ship. Let's process that for a second. Born in 1729 on a slave ship. That means that his mother was pregnant when she was captured, and that she delivered him on the ship into those conditions, and that there was somebody around to tell the story. You've got to ask yourself these kinds of questions in history when you look. His mother died when he was very young. When he was 2, his owner brought him to England. He worked as a servant in Greenwich, and then worked for the Duke of Montague, and Sancho was an autodidact. That is, he taught himself to read, and he spoke out vigorously against the slave trade. That then was enormous for an African to be speaking out against the slave trade, whether in England or on America's shores. It was risky. 1773, Sancho and his wife set up a grocer's shop in Westminster, England. And he was very well known, and his shop became a meeting place for some of the most famous writers, artists, actors, and politicians of the day. Once he accessed his freedom, he became an independent householder and the first black person of African origin to vote in parliamentary elections in Britain. He voted in 1774 and again in 1780. After his death in 1780, his letters were published in a book as well. Whoa! All right, now we got two books. Two books, two writers, Phyllis and Ignatius Sancho. His letters were published in a book which became an immediate bestseller. 5 editions of the book were published, and his writing was used as evidence to support the movement to end slavery. Sancho had mentioned slavery in many of the letters he had written to friends. An example of that is he, in 1778, he commented, these are his exact words, but I'm gonna put the tune to it. He commented that the main aim of all English navigators was money, 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 Sancho said. And he also made people aware of how the lives of Africans were made miserable by the slave trade. This is what he had to say about Phyllis. Sancho was one of the first people of African descent, one of the first critics to praise her. He was also the first person of any ethnicity to openly publish and question the motives of her owners. In 1773, he wrote this. Phyllis's poems do credit to nature and put art, merely as art, to blush. It reflects nothing either to the glory or generosity of her master if she is still a slave, except the glories in the low vanity of having his wanton power in a mind animated by heaven, a genius clearly superior to himself. The list of splendid titled learned names in confirmation of her being the real authoress, alas, shows how very poor the acquisition of wealth and knowledge are without generosity, feeling, and humanity. These good great folks all know and perhaps admired, nay, praised the genius in bondage, and then, like the priests and Levites in the sacred writ, passed by, not one good Samaritan among them. Our second figure, Olaudah Equiano. I know some of y'all know Equiano. 1745, he's born. A former enslaved African, a seaman, and a merchant who wrote an autobiography depicting the horrors of slavery and lobbied Parliament for its abolition. In his biography, he records he was born in what is now Nigeria, kidnapped and sold into slavery as a child. And then he endured the Middle Passage on a slave ship bound for the New World. After a short period of time in Barbados, Equiano was shipped to Virginia and put to work weeding grass and gathering stones. Later, he was bought by a naval captain for about 40 pounds, who named him Gustavus Vassa. You will also see his name recorded in history as this. Equiano was about 12 when he first arrived in England. For part of that time, he stayed in London, and it was here that he learned how to read and write and do arithmetic, or the maths, as they call them. However, Equiano spent much of his time at sea and on warships and trading vessels. He acquired his own freedom, he saved the 40 pounds, and purchased himself. He came to London before returning to sea, working as an able seaman and steward, and once as acting captain. He traveled widely, including the Mediterranean, the Atlantic, the Arctic, in an attempt to reach the North Pole, under the captain command of John Phipps. When he came to London, he came in contact with an anti-slavery campaigner named Granville Sharp. That's an important name. And his friend was kidnapped by their former owner, and he and an attorney named Granville Sharp helped to get him his freedom. Unfortunately, they were unsuccessful. He traveled the Caribbean and ended up meeting Phyllis, his connection to her. He returned to London and worked as a servant for a while, and then he found employment with Sierra Leone Resettlement Project, which was set up to provide a safe place for freed slaves to live and work and not become 12 years a slave. He also formed the Sons of Africa, a group which campaigned for the abolition of public speaking, letter writing, and lobbying Parliament. Then our third person in our little community of character, Otobu Kuguano, 1757, an African anti-slavery campaigner who worked alongside Equiano, and he was born in the part of Africa that we now call Ghana. He was kidnapped in 1770 and taken to the West Indies, where he spent nearly a year enslaved in Grenada. And he was brought to England in 1772 and became one of the leaders of London's African underground community and their campaign to end slavery. And he played a key part in the rescue of many former slaves who did not wish to return to be kidnapped and sold into slavery, and others who wished to escape. In 1787, Kuguano published a book. Whoa! There's a third book. Kuguano published a book called Thought. This is a great title. You know, titles from this period are like paragraphs, so I'm just going to give you the title. Thoughts and Sentiments on the Evil and Wicked Traffic of the Human Species. He was the first published African critic of the transatlantic slave trade and the first African to demand publicly the total abolition of the trade and the freeing of enslaved Africans. And the book seems to have been co-written with Equiano. And it set out the case for the abolition of the slave trade that contained accounts from his own experience. He said, "How could British people call themselves the most civilized people of the world when they were involved in a trade of the barbarous cruelty and injustice and thought that slavery, robbery, and murder were no crime?" He argued that every man in Britain was responsible in some degree for slavery and that the country should set an example and be the first to abolish the trade. And you know what? They were. Two generations before. And you got to think about this in terms of the revolution as it's budding. Because everybody's watching. I mean, okay, now they didn't have internet, obviously. So, you know, but they're getting things, letters and papers and newspapers back and forth, and everybody's gathering around the one literate person who can read, and they're reading, and they're saying, what's the news from England? How's the war? When, you know, what are they talking about? Are we going to go to war? And every African is thinking, am I going to throw my hat in with England, or am I going to throw my hat in with America? Because, you know, you're looking at it, and you're thinking, well, yes, freedom for America, what will that mean for me? What will happen? Coguano goes on to say, "It is not strange that they who ought to be considered as the most learned and civilized people in the world, that they should carry on a traffic of the most barbarous cruelty and injustice, and that many think slavery and robbery and murder no crime. If any man should buy another man and compel him to his service and slavery without any agreement of that man to serve him, the enslaver is a robber. It is as much the duty of a man who is robbed in that manner to get out of the hands of his enslaver as it is for any honest community of men to get out of the hands of rogues and villains." Now, what's his relationship to Wheatley? In 1774, the three, Equiano, Coguano, and Wheatley, begin mission work with a man named Sansom Ockham, who was a Native American pastor, Anglican, and Philippe Kwakwe, the first ordained Anglican priest of African descent, 1774. Wheatley can't go on this mission trip due to her fragile health, but they're publishing and funding mission overseas to Ghana and Sierra Leone. This early African-American mission activity will be cut short by the Revolutionary War. People with their funds and their slaves are going to start fleeing the growing conflict, especially in the north, between England and America. But what is of note is that Phyllis supports the abolitionist, the justice movement with her pen and the Christian movement with her funds. Now, who is the first missionary from America's shores? I will take it. Y'all can talk now. First missionary from America's shores. Hudson Taylor? No. Aha. George Lyle? George Lyle was an African slave, actually, and he predated Hudson Taylor. But those guys were the first ones when it was America. These guys were the first ones. This is the first detailed African-American missionary activity, the first mission activity sent from America's shores 8 years earlier than George Lyle. George Lyle beat Hudson Taylor by a number of years. By 1775, and the only reason that George Lyle is not mentioned because of Hudson Taylor is Hudson Taylor was sent by an agency and George Lyle went independently. Just wanted to add that. By 1775, relations are so bad between England and the colonies that all mission activity is suspended. So during the years of the Revolutionary War, people begin to take sides between being loyalists and new Americans. And Wheatley at this point develops what Vince Coretta, he's like the epic biographer of Wheatley. He says that she develops for the first time an African-American consciousness. She says, "I am an African in America." And she sides with the revolutionaries. Now, knowing what I know now, if I had been me, I would have chosen England, but you know, it's just me. I mean, they abolished slavery sooner. Granville Sharp, an ethical European. An ethical European and a Christian. A civil servant, an attorney, a political reformer, who was proficient in Greek and Hebrew and theology. Don't you wish all our attorneys were theologians? One of the 12 men who, in 1787, formed the Society for Effecting the Abolition of the Slave Trade, he was the first chairman of the society. His interest in the issue went back much further than that, though. At a time when most abolitionists argued that the slave trade was wrong simply based on the fact of the terrible conditions in which enslaved people were kept, he went further than that. And you will not find him published in a book. You will find his arguments, his theological arguments against slavery in legal briefs. Fascinating stuff. He went further than that argument, and he said the very nature of slavery itself was evil. He used his skills to fight a series of legal battles to prevent enslaved people from being taken out of England by force. And many black people resisted enslavement. Many escaped from their owners. However, once they had been escaped, they abandoned or had always been free. Either way, they were always in constant danger of recapture. So he was assisting people legally in the British system. Sharpe's theology went like this. These are his words from his legal brief. He says, "The glorious system of the gospel," this is a good word right here. "The glorious system of the gospel destroys all narrow national partiality and makes us citizens of the world, obliging us to profess universal benevolence. But more especially, we are bound as Christians to commiserate and assist to the utmost of our power all persons in distress or captivity, the widow, the orphan, the stranger, the poor, the slave." He became very good friends with this circle, and they were running people out of the system. Now, you gotta imagine, they were not sending text messages. It took months to get a secret note from one to the other by ship. And you get that, "What's it say?" "Oh, it says here, you know," right? Sorry. She's Australian. I don't want her to think I was making fun of her accent. But he became the leading defender of African people in London, and he saved many African people from being sent back into slavery, particularly in the West Indies, and often at his own expense. And when the time came for Phyllis to access her own freedom, remember, you can run away, you can purchase your freedom, you can negotiate your freedom, you can barter your freedom, or you can work the system. Phyllis worked the system. And it was Granville Sharpe who accompanied her to exploit a loophole in the British system. She went on a tour from the colonies to England to promote her book, and clever and always the artful Jade, with possible self-emancipation in mind, she made travel plans with that loophole in her back pocket. Prior to her manumission, she compares this deep hunger and this sadness over her own loss of personal freedom with her journey through the Middle Passage into slavery, and compares that to America's accessing their freedom. And she wrote that letter to the Earl of Dartmouth, aimed at the heart of one of America's foremost leaders, who's in a position to influence the outcome of both pursuits of freedom. All right, just to close up with Phyllis. Rather than seeking her freedom as a concession pressed from Nathaniel Wheatley, the son, by her powerful friends in New England and back in Mother England, she empowered herself and coerced Nathaniel to exchange one promise for another. Because of this loophole, she had the upper hand. If she went to England and self-emancipated, she would never be able to return to America's shores. She couldn't be forced back to the colonies, however, from England following that ruling. So she insisted that her master's son give his permission in word in the presence of Granville Sharpe, she got her attorney, that she would be freed even if she returned to Boston. The terms of the freedom, the terms of place, they were all hers to make. And she not only did all of that, but sister went and took out an insurance policy on her work to guard against her assets being counted as Wheatley property. Now, freedom in this society was a very fragile thing. But she left as a slave, 1773, and she returned from that trip a free woman. She referred to 1773 as her annus mirabilis, her wondrous year. Freedom, fame, the hope of fortune yet to come, all in front of her, but still marginalized. Why? Because unfortunately, she is now in a vulnerable position. A freed woman of African descent in the 18th century in a world where very little economic opportunities. Wheatley and the Wheatleys, John and Susanna, allowed her to continue to live with them after manumission. She didn't have to serve, but she now supported herself. He died shortly afterwards. She mourns him as a father. Something happened in the Wheatley household. I'm going to try and put those together. Susanna dies. That's my timer. Susanna dies after that in 1773, and she stays in a favorite place with the Wheatley family. And then she lives with John and Mary Wheatley Lathrop, among the refugees who moved from Boston to Providence during the 1775 British occupation of Boston. Wheatley goes with them because she feels they share the same religious values. What were those values? What were her life-defining, life-controlling core concerns and issues at this point in her life? Something happened between the parents' generation and the generation that she's now peer group with. And Reverend Lathrop writes this: "I long for the time when war and slavery shall come to an end, when not only every sect of Christianity, but when Jews and Gentiles, when all nations of men on the face, however differing in color and in other circumstances, embrace as brethren children of one common father and members of one great family." And then he concludes his letter by saying, "I long for the time when all flesh shall know the Lord." The Wheatley's family and spiritual growth, to me, fulfills Paul's request in Philemon, where he says, "You know what the right thing to do is. Set him free and treat him as a brother." Well, y'all want to hear about a blogger troll she had? Because I know we're just about out of time. You want to hear about a troll she had? Somebody trolled her. Okay, now remember, they're going back and forth across the water, right? These letters back and forth. And she begins to write more and more boldly now that she's free. And an anonymous troll, a satirist, alleges that women who pursue intellectual interests, particularly in public, are unnatural and sexually deviant. And so she's working with a group of two others. As a matter of fact, if you go to Boston, the two other women that she developed a writer's group with, they're all memorialized in statues. And there's Phyllis in her classic pose over her. Go to Boston and check it out. It's a beautiful, beautiful statue. And he criticized Wheatley's work over and over again and maligned her character. And he essentially said that they were all sleeping together. And Wheatley got him back with this. She said, "I challenge this white-faced, white-livered enemy of modern poetesses. It will be a black affair for him if he ever comes under my lee, for I will have no mercy on a man who stands up against me on that score. I am a match for the stiffest pedant in the Republic of Letters. He holds up his crest, no doubt, with confidence, as he has hitherto met with no rub for his impudence in turning up the frail part of us female poets. But I would have him draw back in time and not plunge too deep into a subject whose bottom his short line of understanding can never fathom." 1776 to 1784 mark her silent years and the consequences of marriage on her freedom. We do not even know where she's buried today. She died penniless. That's another story for another day. We'll have to do another session. But as we look back over history, we have to ask ourselves in this situation, who was the slave and who was the free? Who was the preacher and who was the congregant? Wheatley stands, by my account, in both death and life as a revolutionary among revolutionaries. She was a witness of true Israel amidst a nation who didn't seem to understand the fellowship of Christ's sufferings or his greatest command to love your neighbor as yourself. The general culture of slavery, remember this, the general culture of slavery, those people handled the word of God on a daily basis. But they only understood its form while denying the transformational power therein. She was an alternative witness. Their community was an alternative witness. And as you now, as historians, go out and people who love literature go out and read, find there are communities like this all over history's timeline. They're everywhere. Find them, because we need new heroes. We need to add the people from the margins to history's record. So you're all commissioned. God bless you. Thank you so much for your time.
You've been listening to the Gospel Coalition podcast. For more gospel-centered resources, visit thegospelcoalition.org. Support for this podcast comes from listeners like you. Learn more and join us at tgc.org/donate.